另外。Chapter 8. Our dusty valley, with its proliferation of bushes and trees, was unusual in the blasted landscape of central Somalia, because it had leaf and shade. It sustained thousands of little creatures, and I could spend a diverting hour defending my mattress from lines of ants, persistent spiders, and curious black and red beetles. Wasp-like insects the size of a fist went motoring on dry wings between the sun-shot trees. And I noticed a weird shimmering call on the brushy slopes that seemed indistinguishable from a horse's whinny. It moved here and there in absolute silence without the violent rustle a horse would make. "Is that some kind of bird?" I asked Raleigh. He listened. "Is a kobo," he said. "It sounded like a disembodied horse." I started to imagine these equine-voiced vultures flapping in silence like spirits from tree to tree. Somalis came down a slope of the valley on the second morning with cases of bottled water and mango juice, boxes of spaghetti, canned tuna, powdered milk, three brands of cookies, a sack of rice, a sack of beans, a sack of flour, and, crucially, toilet paper.
"Trocarive," said Raleigh.
"Up on the bluff," I nodded. For lunch, we ate tuna with bread rolls called roti. The rolls were short loaves, like soft baguettes, not like Indian roti, which is a flatbread. But it was interesting that Somalis had borrowed an Indian word. The word she, for their all-important tea, also pointed across the water, toward Urdu or Arabic. The country was Muslim because of old trade links to Arab cultures to the north, across the Gulf of Aden, to Sudan in the west, beyond Ethiopia, and to the Mughal Empire, far across the sea. Gerlach liked to say Somalia wasn't African, but Oriental. Of course, it was both. On our way to Hobyo, we had seen squat and ragged pyramids in the bush, uncovered by the Indian Ocean tsunami 8 years before. Gerlach had said they were ancient remains of colonization by Egyptian pharaohs. A large, blustery pirate named Abd Nasser, with broad, sloping shoulders and an eager smile, started to use the word sahib with me in the first few days of my captivity.
"Aniga, diga," he said, pointing at himself and me in turn, "sahib."
To me, sahib also sounded Indian, and in South Asia it implied a colonial relationship. But Somalis used it to refer to a relationship of equals. That meaning was closer to the original Arabic. The first sahibs were companions of Muhammad, and pirates used the word among themselves. Abd Nasser's voice was chesty and high, not booming as you'd expect from such a barrel-shaped man. Unlike the other pirates, he never said bitter or sarcastic things. For my shower that afternoon, he brought us two heavy 1.5-liter bottles of clean water. Afterward, he handed us freshening products like skin moisturizer and purple cologne. I thought they were effeminate things to see in a bush camp, so I pointed to a female model on Abd Nasser's moisturizer bottle and teased him.
"For women only, sahib," I said, "not for men."
"Ha, yes," he said with an enormous smile, "sahib."
Abd Nasser proved hard to embarrass. Most pirates were touchy and proud, but he harbored none of their grim suspicion. From then on, we called each other nothing but sahib. The next morning at breakfast, he saved us from an awkward impasse when I complained about the coffee, the vile tea and Nescafe mixture, which Raleigh didn't like either.
"Che cafe,"
I said to the pirates, trying out my grasp of the language.
"No good."
My non-captive self was still intact, and I asked for simple boiled water to mix with our satchels of instant coffee, as if decent coffee were a basic necessity, some kind of human right. The guards listened in bewilderment. The atmosphere grew tense.
"Not make them angry, Michael," muttered Raleigh.
At last, Abd Nasser said,
"Ha, yes,"
and boiled a kettle of fresh bottled water. The pirates watched us make instant coffee with hot water and powdered milk, then gave our innovative beverage a name.
"Water cafe."
"Ha, water cafe,"
I said. We were learning to communicate. Chapter 9. Raleigh and I talked in short bursts under the canopy of leaves, and during our silences my mind seemed to flip through pages of memory like a film. The impulse to study the past reminded me of those supposed moments before you die, life passing before your eyes, except that my sense of urgency just went on and on. During my first week of captivity, I was tense and afraid for my life, so I called up the past like a man dying in slow motion. First, I remembered Berlin. At breakfast, I liked to sit in the kitchen window of my apartment and look at the massive, waving trees at the corner of Helmholtzplatz, a park where a 19th-century street lamp stood next to an odd, space-age plastic street clock. I missed having a soft-boiled egg with my coffee and listening to the BBC. I'd never been rich, but in the Somali wilderness, the coffee, the radio, and the egg felt like impossible luxuries. I thought about the words on the rear of the technical, Kibirjabiye, to bring down the arrogant, and wondered if the same technical had accompanied us out to the coast. Most likely. I had not acted arrogant or overweening in Galkayo, but to the Somalis, I was a white man, a symbol of colonialism and latter-day wars. It had been arrogant to think I could come to Somalia and expect to be treated as anything else.
"You have made a mistake," Boudin had said.
"Mistakes are human." I started to think back years rather than weeks or months to find out where I'd gone wrong. Maybe it was normal to gnash my teeth and rake the past for answers. It certainly wasn't rational. But camping in the woods like this reminded me of a summer when my parents and I drove up Pacific Coast Highway and stopped at Big Sur by a freshwater stream, close enough to the ocean to smell salt among the redwoods and pines. In those days, the name Big Sur had a countercultural flair. My only experience of it was trout fishing with Dad and burning some roasted marshmallows. Now I missed the whole thing with every fiber of my heart. The salty Pacific and the campground dust and the rich, vanilla-tinged odor of the California forest. During that road trip, Dad was drinking hard. Mom exiled him on some nights to sleep outside. I noticed the friction only when I stepped out in the morning to use the campground toilets and saw Dad wrapped in a dark blue sleeping bag, covered in dew, beside the wheels of the van. It always happened in silence. This tension between them smoldered, but never flared into the open. Somehow Mom kept in good humor and excellent maternal form throughout this shambling trip, as if the family weren't under threat. I had no brothers or sisters, so the hopes of my parents had settled on my unsuspecting head like a heap of wet hay. Growing up means leaving certain expectations behind, along with received ideas from your childhood. On the other hand, they stick to you. Back then I wanted to be an astronaut or a doctor. I could have been a doctor. I could have trained for any profession at all. Instead, I had to be a writer. "Michael," said Abdinasser, my sahib, holding out a handful of cot.
"Sahib?"
"No."
"Cigarette?"
said another pirate. It was a game for the pirates to find out what the hostages would consume. Out of boredom, I took a cigarette. The pirate handed me a lighter. Oddly enough, it had a cheap photo of the Lorelei, a rock formation on the Rhine River near Koblenz. My parents had met in that part of the world.
"Thanks," I said.
I remembered photos of my father from that era, showing a more suave and self-controlled man than the one I remembered. A snapshot from the early 60s showed him wearing a trim black suit with polished shoes, next to a new white Volkswagen, pinching a slim cigarette. In those days, he worked with Dennis Lyon. They might have traveled together to the Koblenz office. I had time to imagine them seeing the Rhine Valley for the first time on a smoke-filled train. "That's the Lorelei," Dennis might have said, gazing out the window at some cliffs beside the river, and he would have explained the legend of a beautiful siren singing river navigators to their doom. Dad was smart, but indifferently educated. He'd spent a semester at MIT in the 50s and finished his training in the Navy. "I guess I thought the sirens were Greek," I imagined him saying, and Dennis would have coughed out a dry, sarcastic laugh.
"Well, I think this one's a blonde, Bert."
They had belonged to the hard-drinking culture of aerospace in the 60s, practical but hell-raising men who remembered childhoods during World War II. The global reach of the United States, with its satellites and fighter planes, was a project they supported. For them, it belonged to the natural order after 1945. America's newfound significance after Hitler's defeat was a sensible counterweight to communism. Mom in those days had a generous, marquee-worthy smile, and my parents were sleek and fashionable, annoyed and bewildered by 60s counterculture. If drugs and alcohol infected our household in Northridge, misgivings about the American Imperium never did. I spent hours, eventually days, rebuilding chapters of my family's past. Everything flowed like an underground stream. The strange association with Noor, the gap-toothed security chief, cast me back to scenes I could remember with Dennis, and scenes I had to invent. Aerospace used to infuse life in Southern California, and I remembered the tone of that world, the banalities, and the international glamour. And I remembered Dennis and Sylvia sitting on our concrete patio in Northridge after family dinners, smoking cigarettes and speaking German. The women spoke it with uncommon grace. The men sounded more like drill sergeants from Gomer Pyle. They sat for hours on dry Los Angeles evenings with glasses of wine and flickering citronella candles. It was easy to reject the American suburbs, easy to disregard the whole military-industrial complex for its weapons and its habits of war. But the keenest emotion I felt now was a profound sense of failure, not just for the catastrophe of getting kidnapped, but for a sense of spiritual waste, for not having loved everyone enough. I was at the rough edge of what I thought would be a foreshortened life, and the memories amounted to a frenetic and subconscious groping around for the person I had been, since I couldn't accept the label hostage, and didn't yet know what it meant. Chapter 10. The next morning we woke up to find a pirate squatting near our beds, his head wrapped in a turban. He was tall and fine-featured, and he watched us in the gray dawn with a long, mistrustful stare. No one prepared food, not even a thermos of tea. For breakfast, Raleigh and I shared a packet of cookies. "Who is that man?" I mumbled to Raleigh, nodding at the lean, unsmiling guard. "I don't think I've seen him before." Raleigh had. "Angelo say he's Ali's brother," he said. He'd replaced Ahmed Birie, who had disappeared after his beating. Too injured by the boss to continue as group leader, apparently. Kat arrived in the early afternoon, and Raleigh made fun of it. Every day he put on a grinning, grandfatherly act for the ritual arrival of the drug. "Chat," he said to Angelo. "Chat," he said to a guard named Hersey. "Chat," he said to Abdenasser the Sahib. They all lifted their thumbs. "Why do you say chat instead of cut?" I said.
"Is their word, Michael? Is what the Somalis say?"
That was true. Our pirates all softened the first consonant and said chat. A regional difference. But Raleigh had never heard it pronounced another way. "Do you have chat in the Seychelles?" I teased him.
"Oh, no, Michael."
Raleigh watched them unwrap their bundles of leaf.
"They no feed us," he observed, "but they buy this fucking chat."
Ali's brother ordered Raleigh to his feet in the mid-afternoon and marched him across the valley and up the hill. I didn't know what was going on, but Abdenasser, my sahib, made a telephone gesture with his hand. Raleigh returned after half an hour, seeming despondent. The pirate's demand was still outrageous, he said, and his family in the Seychelles held out little hope.
"The pirates say if they do not get money in 24 hours, I will starve," he said in a hoarse and quiet voice. "My son-in-law not know what to say. He tell me, 'Papa, God will take you up to him. God will accept you.'"
Ali's brother stood in front of us.
"Come on," he said to me.
We climbed the hill. On the grass-grown bluff, I saw a land cruiser, a fire pit, and several more armed Somalis. A pair of men sat cross-legged under an acacia, and I recognized one as Ali Dulai, holding a pistol in his lap. The other was a plump and fleshy man with a high voice, who called himself Omar. He spoke decent English.
"We will have to call your family," he said, fingering a mobile phone.
"I don't have much family," I said.
"Your wife?"
"I am divorced."
"Your father?"
"My father died when I was young."
"What about your mother?" "You will need to ask for a ransom of $20 million.
My heart sank like a bag of sand. A demand of $20 million was pathological. I must have given a desolate smirk.
"Do not laugh,"
shouted Omar, and Ali Dulai raised his pistol, threatening to beat me.
"It is not a joke. We have information that you are a spy."
"I am not a spy."
"Tell them not to listen for your voice,"
Omar pointed at the clouds and added, as if to clarify this mysterious demand,
"Tell them not to listen with planes. Tell them we need $20 million. "My mother doesn't have $20 million,
I said.
"Nobody has that. If she does not send the money in 24 hours, we will stop giving you food and water. You must tell her that.
Your treatment until now has been good. Tell her that. But if she does not pay in 24 hours, you will starve.
I said nothing.
And tell her to deliver a message to President Obama. If someone tries to rescue you, you will be shot. Tell President Obama.
We don't know President Obama.
Your mother will tell him. It is not a joke. Many Somalis were killed last week in a rescue. This man lost his brother.
Dulai, looking crazed, aimed his pistol at my face and shook it. I'd never stared down the borehole of a firearm before. My heart vibrated, and the dark notion that he might pull the trigger, that I might just see a muzzle flash and flop over in the dust, infected me with a heavy, unusual calm. I wanted to leap and run, but that would have been stupid. I had to sit and accept the prospect of a sudden death. Omar held out his hand to quell Dulai, and I blinked, half surprised in a rush of adrenaline that I hadn't been shot dead.
What happened in the raid? I managed to ask.
13 people were killed.
Including hostages?
Yes.
Nausea rose in me. Omar handed me his phone, but I choked on the idea of tapping my mother's number into it. The proper place to call was the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting.
Can't you bring my backpack? I said.
The pirates took it. A maroon backpack with my camera. All my phone numbers.
We don't have it.
You must have it. Who else would have it?
We must make a phone call.
I squinted around the bluff. Half a dozen Somalis paced here and there with rifles. The angle of the land cruiser indicated the direction of the road. But escape was impossible for now. I sighed and dialed the number. Omar took the phone, and when somebody answered, he said,
"Hold on, please, for the hostage."
I said, "Hello?" and heard my mother ask, in a sane and sensible voice, for the name of my childhood cat. Someone had prepared her for the call. I repeated what Omar had said about the president. "The men here say I'll be shot if there's a rescue attempt. They mentioned something about a rescue the other day."
"Oh, yes, the rescue,"
she said, and from her tone I thought something had gone right. There must have been headlines, TV reports. But I decided not to upset the pirates by asking for details.
"Mom, they want $20 million.
She seemed short of breath.
"Where are we going to get $20 million?
Good question. I had no kidnapping insurance. My application for coverage had been rejected in the weeks before we left. Independent journalists were often turned down, but now I was boiling in hell for my decision not to call off the entire trip. I delivered a veiled message to Susie, my ex-girlfriend in Berlin and an author. "Tell her 3 books to Judith."
"Which books?"
Mom said. "Susie will understand." I wanted Susie to send 2 manuscripts and a book proposal to her agent in London. "Sell the books," I thought. "Let me help raise the money." Of course, raising millions of dollars with a book, even 3 books, was a joke. But the prospect of tangling up my family with these nasty criminals made my stomach swim. "I'm also supposed to tell you that I won't get any food if you don't send money now," I said. "They'll stop my water and food in 24 hours. The apparent high stakes of this call summoned so much adrenaline that knowing what to say was impossible. She had handwritten notes beside the bed, a list of things to ask, but notes were flimsy preparation for a conversation with pirates.
"Whenever a phone call came in like that, my brain just went in circles," she said later.
To me, her questions sounded cool-minded and calm. The FBI had coached her well, but her thinking blurred on the phone, and so did mine. Later, she couldn't even remember the pirates' promise to let me starve.
"I was probably in shock," she said.
After the call, I clambered down the slope again with Ali's brother. The silence on the camp and the slanting late afternoon light felt eerie. Raleigh had nothing to eat. He lay on his mattress and sipped bottled water.
"How much they want for you?"
he asked. $20 million?
"Yeah, me too."
I couldn't believe that.
"Really?"
"Yeah. $20 million for me and Vark. $10 million each.
Jesus."
"Your family can pay?"
he said. "Not even close, Raleigh."
"It's too much," he agreed with a grave expression. "You know how much is $20 million in my country?"
"I can take a guess," I said. He creased his forehead while he made the calculations.
"It's a lot of money. You can buy house, you can buy car."
I chuckled. "A pretty nice car." We wondered if the pirates would feed us. We felt taut with hunger. I thought about my phone call, about the shock of mortality in front of Dulai's weapon and the ranting of Omar.
"We have information that you are a spy."
Was that what Boudin had meant by mistake back in town? Did he consider me a spy?
Had a rumor burned through the savannah that I worked for NATO or Atalanta, and could this misunderstanding be corrected? Or was I giving the laws of this underworld too much credit for logic? In the distance, we heard the sound of a tool, of metal and earth, like a spade slicing the ground. A breeze stirred the branches, and the horse-like vultures whinnied somewhere on the slope. Raleigh rubbed his face with one hand.
Michael, he mumbled, why you come to this bad place?
I can't remember, I said.
Part 3. Living in civilization keeps us civilized. Chapter 1. Two nights after the phone call, I drifted half awake in the moonlight, because the Somalis were shuffling and gathering up clothes and guns. I tried to sleep again, but Ali's brother ordered us up.
Go, 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 go! Come on!
I stood and settled my wrist in the sling. Pirates picked up our mattresses and wandered down the valley. Where are we going? I said, and when I missed my cue to walk, Ali's brother hit me in the face.
What the fuck was that for?
The Somali said, shh, and someone shoved me.
Go, go, go!
We pushed through switch-like tree branches and thorn bushes until somebody discovered a high shelf of dirt overhung by low trees. One pirate climbed up a face of rock and soil and ordered us to follow.
You want me to climb that?
I said.
Ha!
Yes.
My wrist is broken. Go, 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 go!
The wall stood 8 or 10 feet high. We clambered up on roots and rocks to a natural, hollowed-out thicket. Our mattresses were handed up, and someone folded them into this hollow and spread them on the ground.
Okay, Michael,
one of the pirates said, pointing into our new home through the thorns.
No.
The pirates bedded down outside the thicket. It was like a slumber party. For a while we heard no other noise besides a strange, trilling chorus of nighttime creatures in the valley, a million unseen insects and birds offering thin rills of song to the desert sky. I couldn't sleep. My face still stung from the blow, and soon we had to listen to a handful of our captors whispering, Allahu Akbar, and genuflecting in their cotton sarongs. Until then, I had never seen a pirate pray. I had believed the conventional wisdom that pirates were un-Islamic, irreligious, so listening to the prayer boiled my blood. Rationally, of course, I knew that wondering how a pirate could justify himself to God was as ridiculous as asking a mafia hitman why he went to church. But imagining these contradictions in a stranger is different from experiencing them as a captive. The idea that a pirate could pretend to holiness, would even pray at the sight of such a naked crime, opened a ferocious channel of rage. I remembered what Gerlach had said in the car when we drove past the mosque in Hobyo. Pirates are not real Muslims. I also remembered my visit to Djibouti in 2009 when I spent 4 days on the frigate Gediz, where an officer had said the same thing. The Gediz was a Turkish warship in the NATO fleet, charged with capturing stray pirates in the Gulf of Aden, and during our brief September voyage, the high-wind summer monsoon had just ended, so pirate season was about to start. But it's Ramadan now, our minder, Yashar, had said. It might be quieter for this reason. Yashar had moody eyes and an appealingly awkward, earnest manner. Another journalist on board asked if Ramadan would be a motivation for pirates. I've heard they like to go out during Ramadan, he said, because if they die, the rewards for jihad are double. Yashar shook his head. Pirates were infidels, in his opinion, as an observant Muslim. They are thieves. He gave us his line of argument by quoting a story from the Hadith, a body of traditional stories about Muhammad. When he was coming from a war, Muhammad told his followers, "We have just come from the lesser jihad. Now it is time for the greater jihad." That means the inner struggle, the struggle against yourself, your feelings, said Yashar. Theft was a selfish temptation for every true Muslim to resist. So I don't think the pirates can do this for jihad. If they say they do, they have misused the word. I liked Yashar immensely, and most Muslims I knew held the same common sense ideas. What he'd said about Ramadan, though, implied that pirates observed it. I had this epiphany rather late, lying in the dark next to Raleigh. I'd been so quick to agree with Yashar on the Gediz that I had missed the more important idea. Pirates, who rode diesel-powered skiffs to hijack massive cargo vessels,
who didn't mind notoriety as thieves in the international press, fasted for Ramadan. Understanding this required some background. Yashar couldn't represent Islam as a whole, because nobody could. The religion has never had a pope. By saying pirates weren't religious, Yashar and Gerlach had both engaged in takfir, the rejection of one Muslim by another. Like most Somalis, though, my guards were Sufi. They were also Sunni as opposed to Shiite. Sufism coexists with either denomination. Many Orthodox Muslims rejected the old, sometimes quirky, highly mutable traditions of Sufism, but Sufism had followers around the world, even in places, like Somalia, where people often didn't bother with the word. In many regions, Islam had expanded precisely because Sufis could tolerate the absorption of odd, provincial, non-Islamic beliefs. Rashad Kapuscinski's neat distinction between two kinds of Islam would have categorized average Somalis as people of the road and of the bazaar, and lined up Sufism with an Islam of sea travelers and businessmen. Ordinary Somalis listened to music on their phones, smoked cigarettes, and chewed khat. They venerated their ancestors. They had integrated their ancient clan structures into a Sufi cult of genealogies and saints. For Sunni fundamentalists, though, music and cigarettes were religious infractions, and sainthood and ancestor veneration were deep heresies. A rift between Sufism and fundamentalism partly explained Somalia's ever-shifting civil war. The Wahhabi jihadists in al-Shabaab had declared regular Somalis, like my pirates, impure, and some of our guards would later boast about their battles with Shabaab elsewhere in Galmudug. As a foreign journalist in another setting, I would have wanted Sufis like these gunmen on my side. But whenever I thought about pirates, part of my brain wiped the religious dimension away. Until this rage-filled moment in the bush, I had thought of Somali pirates as lapsed Sufis by definition, indifferent and godless, not the sort of men who would pray in the wilderness at night. Of course, I knew about Sufi whirling dervishes in Turkey. I knew about the Sufism of hippies. I had even read Robert Graves's mysterious assertion that Sufism was older than Islam itself. He'd called Sufism an ancient spiritual Freemasonry whose origins have never been traced or dated. If some Sufis call Islam the shell of Sufism, this is because they believe Sufism to be the secret teaching within all religions. It all seemed wonderfully strange and enlightened. The Sufi poet Rumi, in his famous Masnavi epic, wrote that thousands of hidden kings were exalted by the love of God, and by kings, he meant the unknown dead as well as King David, Jesus, and Muhammad. I swear by those made of pure light from him, such men are fish in which his oceans swim. But Rumi's graceful verse was light years from our camp in that dry and desolate valley, and it would be months before I understood what was going on. Chapter 2. In the morning, the camp was silent, but I had to pee. We'd slept under a thick, sideways-growing tree with sharp thorns and loose, fibrous bark. A sandstone boulder leaned over our feet. Stiffly, carefully, I arranged my wrist in the sling and crawled through a gap in the thicket of thorns. Outside our rustic prison, I saw a half-dozen Somalis cocooned in their own sarongs lying on dirty mats. They used the word ma'awis for sarong, and now I saw the thin skirts could serve as sleeping bags in the bush as well as traditional dress. They were just long tubes of cloth, imported usually from Indonesia. They kept off the damp. One cocoon stirred. A thin, effeminate Somali named Abdul lifted his head. Kadi, I announced. He waved his hand in the direction we had come, down the wall of rock and dirt. We were stuffed in a corner of the wooded valley, which wasn't a single long cleft in the savanna, but a system of overgrown crevasses that were probably dry riverbeds, or wadis. Our crevasse had a sloping gravel bottom and some tall outcroppings of sandstone. The whole valley, I thought, might flood in a heavy rain. I found a private place to pee behind an outcropping, beyond Abdul's line of vision, which must have annoyed him. I squinted along the wadi and saw our path from the previous night. A thick fallen log lay across the trail. If I wanted to, I thought, I could run out in that direction, I did have shoes on. But where to? The guards might hear my footsteps or catch sight of me clambering over the log. They might also be good trackers. A young Somali in Galkayo had told me a story of a girl who ran into the bush to escape her family before they could subject her to the ritual of womanhood referred to as female circumcision, which is not circumcision, but the bloody removal of the clitoris using broken glass or a razor blade. Her people were nomads, the Somali had said with a shrug. They can track animals for days. Of course they found her. I returned to camp. Angelo crawled into our thicket and sat politely on the ground with his rifle. He guarded us in silence for a while until Raleigh thought to ask, "Angelo, why we move last night?" Angelo pointed at the sky, mimicked the flight of an aircraft with his hand, and used an LED on his cigarette lighter to flash the ground. "Airplane?" I said. "Or helicopter?" Angelo nodded vaguely. "Helicopter here or out there?" I said, and waved into the uncertain distance. He imitated the wave. "Hmm," I said. Angelo sat with his limbs folded like a wooden marionette's, half shading his eyes with one hand, out of shyness or contrition. I couldn't tell if he meant that someone had attempted a rescue or that surveillance planes had buzzed the camp, but I felt a charge of sudden, irrational hope. Our first few days in this camp were quiet, though the pirates claimed we were surrounded by Al-Shabaab. When a car arrived with provisions, Ahmed Diriye came down the slope looking sweaty and excited from a difficult drive. He chattered and somebody translated. Al-Shabaab had stopped the car at a roadblock, he said. The gunmen had detained Ahmed Diriye and his driver, tied their hands behind their backs, and shot the driver, a man we'd met called Moussa, in the head. For some reason they hadn't shot Ahmed Diriye. "Why?" I asked. "Al-Shabaab!" There was no other explanation. At first I felt queasy about the death of someone I knew. Then I wondered if the story was meant to frighten us. Abdinasa the Sahib carried down a load of cooked pasta and plastic shopping bags, shouted, "Sahib!" and plopped one bag in front of us on the dirt.
"Basto!"
he added. The spaghetti was mixed with onion and boiled goat, somehow still warm. Raleigh and I had forks, but no bowls. We had to take bites, one at a time, straight from the dusty bag. Abdinasser also brought us a much-needed nail clipper. After lunch, I tried it out, and the first thing I noticed about this item was the dullness of the blades. They chewed more than clipped. I sat on a boulder near the edge of our dirt platform, aiming the fragments of nail into a trench of bushes and rocks. This process took a while. My position left me exposed to the sky. Ali's brother stood outside our thicket and said, "Michael." I decided to ignore him. "Michael," he said again, and I started to feel annoyed. Did he really want me to move? Why couldn't I sit on a rock? I went on chewing at my nails and noticed an odd faint sound, an uneven buzz in the sky. Ali's brother crawled into our hollow. He gazed with dead eyes and gave me a direct order in Somali. I knew what he wanted, but the mechanical noise was distant enough to ignore. He snapped a twig from the overhead tree and started to whip my arm, the way a nomad might whip cattle.
"Now don't hit me," I said in a loud voice.
He kept at it, so I shouted,
"Don't fucking hit me! What is this man doing?"
And the other Somalis scolded him through the thicket. He shoved me toward the mattress, and I yelled another protest. By now, the overhead noise was undeniable, and my heart beat with excitement.
"Shh," said the pirates.
The plane seemed to move in long, lowering circles over the valley. I listened to the propellers and imagined a fat, long-distance Orion, something like the plane that had filmed the Taipan pirates from 7 miles off. We'd camped in this valley for almost a week without hearing a passenger plane, so a commercial flight path was out of the question. I said something out loud to Raleigh, but the Somalis hissed and Raleigh held up a knotty finger.
"Not make them angry, Michael."
The idea that someone knew enough about our location to send an Orion gave me a thrill of terror and hope. Angelo's gossip about a plane, like the talk of a rescue during my phone call, was enough to raise the proposition that another raid might target us. The corkscrew traced by the plane seemed to rise again. We couldn't tell if it had spotted our camp. It never flew straight overhead. A real spy mission could have watched us from several miles off, well out of sight, which meant that if we could hear the plane, someone wanted us to hear the plane, unless it had just wandered into range by accident like a lumbering bear. At last the sound grew faint again and vanished. Our guards sat around in unmistakable terror.
"They scared, eh?"
said Raleigh.
"They think that plane come for you."
I smiled for the first time in several days.
I think maybe it did.
Chapter 3 While Raleigh and I tried to sleep that night, we heard a passionate argument among the guards about a helicopter and a telephone, and I started to wonder if the hostage rescue Mom had mentioned bore some relation to my capture. The pirates had stolen my smartphone, among other things, in my backpack. Ashwin would have provided the number to both Washington and Berlin. The raid had targeted the other hostages, obviously. I couldn't imagine SEALs moving in on a camp that wasn't well known to American surveillance. But suppose they had some reason to think I was there, too. Suppose my phone had found its way to that camp. Suppose a pirate had turned it on. My heart thumped. If the hostages were dead, I would have their lives on my conscience. 2 days later, another car arrived, and a number of new Somalis hiked down to the camp. They brought a watermelon, more vanilla cookies, and a live goat, which Angelo slaughtered on the bluff. Our camp also gained a new boss. Ali's brother disappeared, and a quirky and gentle new Somali stayed behind. Mohammed Talil had a shy, snaggle-toothed smile and a furs of almost Ethiopian-looking hair. He seemed at first like a low-ranking man, a cook, because he was so diligent about building a fire and providing us rice and tea. Unlike the others, he seemed to enjoy his work.
"We call this a cat in the Seychelles," said Raleigh.
"What do you mean?" I said.
"A man like that who work in the kitchen."
The next morning, a Somali dropped something rectangular at my knees, a wallet-like case.
"Okay, boss,"
he said, and added 2 packs of batteries. From the furtive way he behaved, I knew to keep it quiet from the other pirates. Raleigh noticed and said,
"Ah, you get our radio?"
"Shh," I whispered. "We can listen to the news." Reception was terrible, but I found English lessons in Chinese, news in Somali, something in Arabic, and the keening lonely call to prayer. With difficulty, I stumbled across a station with officious British voices.
"Holy shit.
What you got?"
mumbled Raleigh.
"It's the BBC World Service."
After 2 weeks in the wilderness, the World Service felt like a miracle. I stood up to ask Talil for water cafe. By the time another news bulletin came around, in half an hour, I could sit on a boulder in the cold morning sun with a glass mug of instant coffee in one hand and the murmuring staticky radio to my ear, feeling almost human. All I needed was a boiled egg. We listened for news about Somalia. Instead, we learned about a hurricane off Madagascar, a sinking Italian cruise ship, and Syria's deepening civil war.
"I work on a cruise ship like that," Raleigh said after a while.
"Really?"
I said.
"Where?" And he was off. Raleigh's term of relative silence had ended. Between spurts of news on the BBC, I learned all about his previous life. In the 80s, he had worked as a steward on a Greek cruise line, sailing the Mediterranean from Italy to Israel. He mentioned passengers who tipped well and passengers who didn't. After 2.5 decades, those details remained in his mind. He also told a good story about a forced air heater in a hotel room in Greece.
"I put this electric heater on, and the stove, you know, it was gas. You can make your tea on this stove, but it leak. And me, I don't smell this gas."
His room had a sliding glass door overlooking an Athens street. When he turned on the heater, it ignited the leaking gas and forced a tremendous plume of flame through the door.
"Michael,"
said Raleigh, squeezing his eyes at the memory,
"that glass shattered. Thank God nobody was in the road. The man there, the manager, he say it cost 3,000 drachma to fix. I gave him 4,000. It's not a lot of money. But he say, not talk about this to your wife."
He acted roosterish about his early career as a fisherman and a laborer in the 1960s, when he went skin diving for sea cucumbers and sea turtles. His job on the cruise line represented an international phase, when he saw the world and earned a good salary. His wife had worked as a house cleaner in the Middle East during the same period, and they traveled back and forth, a season in the Seychelles, a season abroad. But after several years, they settled in Mahé for good. Raleigh grew out of his life as an employee by purchasing the Aride, a yellow fishing cruiser with a sleeping cabin and 4 fixed drop lines. For the first time in his life, he ran his own show. Long experience with the Seychelles reefs and shoals made him a good skipper. He sailed out for days at a time.
"Other fishermen, they follow me," he boasted, "because in the harbor they see I come in with a lot of fish."
"What do you catch? Red snapper, island snapper, like that?" But now the Arede was gone. He thought about it every day. He'd neglected to buy insurance. His family was poor.
"Michael," he concluded, "when you poor people look at you like this,"
he gave an evil squint,
"but when you rich people say, 'Look at this rich man.'"
Raleigh was a chatterbox by nature, and once he decided to talk, he chattered about anything that came into his head. I never felt bored. His English reminded me of the French-inflected Caribbean patois in Derek Walcott's plays Taijon and His Brothers, or The Sea at Dauphin. His voice could be dirty, low-down, clever, funny, and sad. He told me a Seychelles legend about a madman in the woods.
"I like the dodacia under a rock," he said. "We say that in the Seychelles. Dodacia, like a crazy man. He go to the forest because his wife no good. He sit under a rock and laugh, laugh, laugh. These men got us here in the forest like that."
Chapter 4. A sandstone rock in the forest, though, was no match for Somalia's weather. Even during the dry season, water could pour like a faucet into the arid savanna. One night, we woke up to a wet patter on the leaves. The pirates told us to pack our sparse belongings into plastic bags. They drove us like cattle through a gentle rain, down the crevasse, up a trail, across the thorn-grown bluff, until we piled, wet and exhausted, just before the downpour started, into a waiting car. We sped through the forest and the bush at top speed for several hours until the pirates pulled off to one side of the road and waited on a moonlit expanse. We had outrun the rain, at least for now. Somali folk music pounded and scraped from the stereo. We had no choice but to listen to a stark female voice and a careening, melancholy oud. In a Somali musician's hands, the oud can sound spare and thorny, like the savanna itself, and this song was so strange, I started to pay attention. The woman used a glottal stop to keep time. A glottal stop is a consonant sound in Somali. It's written into words as an apostrophe or as a C, which is why one common spelling of Galkayo includes a C, Galkayo, and why Sa'ad has two syllables. The woman sang whole trills of glottal stops in perfect time to drive the rhythm of her song. My resistance melted. The music had a strange beauty, and the bending, frantic oud reminded me of American blues. I had just started to forget where I was when our driver pulled out his smartphone, flipped through some pictures, and tilted his phone back to show me a photo of my own face in the dark. A chill washed through my limbs. Pirates laughed. It was my own author photo, ripped from the New York Times. The bosses must have sent it around to their foot soldiers' phones. Soon we drove to a dismal stone ruin with faint light glowing behind colored rags in the windows. Pirates wrapped a blindfold around my head. I stumbled up a broken stone staircase, and when they unwrapped me, I stood in a half-lit honeycomb of crumbling, filthy rooms. Pirates listened to twanging folk music and sat in front of piles of leaf, chewing their narcotic cud and staring up with startled, stoned, urgent expressions, as if we'd interrupted them. Thorn brambles were stuffed in one doorway, tumbleweeds in place of a door. Someone led us down the hall to a tattered cloth hanging in another doorway, and behind it, three mattresses lay on the ground. A tall man slept on one.
"It is Mark," Raleigh whispered.
We set down our bags. Mark stirred and spoke from the corner, and Raleigh answered him in minor-toned Creole. In the light from a fluorescent lantern, I saw Mark was an old man with stiff limbs. I shook his leathery hand.
"He say is getting better," said Raleigh. "He feed himself now."
"Better from the electrocution?" I asked.
"Yeah."
A man came in wearing a white shirt and dress slacks. I recognized him in the uneven light as Boudin, the translator from our first house.
"You are safe here now. You are okay," he said. "You can sleep."
I didn't feel safe. "Are we in Hobyo?" I said.
"Yes."
One or two men in another room began to pray, and their chanting mixed with the clamor of folk music on their phones.
"Can you ask the men to turn their music down?" I said. "It's very loud."
"I will ask,"
he said. But these men are soldiers. So? Ask them to be quiet soldiers. He went out. The volume lowered on one or two phones. Boudin returned and I remembered my manners and thanked him. He wondered if it would rain again. He was in a hopped-up, conversational mood, although he'd instructed us to sleep. I hope it won't rain because I want to go fishing tomorrow, he said.
Really?
I said. What do you catch? Boudin dressed like a small-time businessman, a hustler putting on airs more than some kind of fisherman.
Lobster. I fish for lobster, he said. I hope tomorrow I will catch 5 kg.
He raised his eyebrows and smiled. 5 kg, about 11 pounds, was meant to be a lot for a man like him. I remembered thinking before that he was a world-class liar. Now his will to disorient me rattled my nerve. Was I expected to believe, on this particular layer of hell, that pirates were just needy fishermen? I remembered Boudin's admonition from our first meeting in Hobyo. You have made a mistake, and wondered if he would repeat it. My real mistake had been coming to Somalia at all. What did I think I would find around here? Pirates who trusted writers? Truth? Some war correspondents come away from the battlefield more disoriented than before, less confident about the facts, and by now I just wanted to be unconscious. I wasn't in the mood to hear Boudin offer up some pirate public relations line. This trashed and nightmarish stone building stood in a uniquely desolate part of the world, where escape was impractical and even my dreams of freedom had no obvious place to wander. But it was Boudin's insistent dishonesty that gave me the creeps.
That man gets seasick, Raleigh said when he left. Boudin, he not a fisherman,
I snorted.
How do you know?
When I come to Hobyo on the Arvide, he said, he get on with some other bosses. After 5 minutes, he go to the rail and vomit.
Chapter 5. At dawn, I saw more of the house. We'd slept in a filthy room colored with layers of pastel paint, flaking blue and yellow and dusty green. The thick walls rose 12 feet overhead to reveal a barn-like space crossed by rafters. Birds fluttered among them. The slanted corrugated roof had rust holes that shone bright from the morning sun. My blood pressure had a way of zinging to a certain level every morning when I woke up from a benign dream to realize I was in Somalia. Angelo now sat folded beside the doorway with a rifle across his thighs, deep in thought, shielding his forehead with one languid hand. He noticed me, Star. I cleared my throat and said, "Kadi?" He leaned through the hanging cloth to give an order. Feet shuffled, Kalashnikovs clacked. The hall was like the room, a pastiche of flaking paint, except that a patterned ceiling that must have once decked the entire building still remained, half broken away. Lengths of wire-like metal suspended the remnants of it. This ruin, in its day, would have been a well-appointed European-style house. "Toilet?" I asked, since no Somalis were offering guidance. One of them waved into a room near his end of the hall. There was a toilet inside, but it looked as if someone had assaulted it with a sledgehammer. The floor had a litter of rock, plaster, and dried human shit. The toilet was a broken plinth of porcelain with a hole gaping into a stinking, watery sump. I peed into it. "Somali bullshit," I whispered to the guards on my way back, making sure to remove my shoes and leave them in the filthy hall. By now, Raleigh had woken up. "What is this place?" I said when I sat down.
"I not know. I stay here before," he glanced around. "Angelo, say, is 70 years old.
"Really?
Thick walls, eh? And this roof is good iron."
The deep-set windows had broad sills of concrete on either side. The walls were a yard thick and almost 12 feet high. The design felt fascist monumental, simple but massive, like a farmhouse built by Mussolini. 70 years ago, I said, "the fascists were in charge here. This place might be Italian."
"Yeah?"
The colonies of Italian and British Somaliland had united in 1960 to become modern Somalia, but during World War II, they had fought on behalf of their colonial masters. Gerlach had told me one of his earliest memories was the sight of Somali soldiers marching through Gakayo for the Italians. I remembered an excellent book by Gerald Hanley called Warriors, about Somalia during and after World War II. Hanley was an ethnic Irishman,
born in England and sent by the British Army to East Africa. He had no passionate loyalty to the British Empire, so his book is an independent-minded snapshot of Somalia during that dramatic span of years when war had weakened Europe's colonial grip on much of the world, and Africa was full of hope. "I can remember sitting by the waterhole," he wrote, "wondering how it was that the war I had joined because it was against fascism had landed me in ragged shorts and shirts in a geography like the moon where fascism had vanished like a thin mist and the war had rolled far away into distant silences." Mark stood up, gingerly, to use the toilet. He was shy, almost docile, and he looked older than Raleigh, though he was younger by 7 years. He had imploring eyes and white, dusted hair, and he held his arms incurled, like broken wings. When he returned to lie down, I saw how weak his arms were from the electrocution. But I caught no trace of resentment in his manner. He was gentle and calm. He lit up when Raleigh spoke to him in patois, which sounded like mischievous broken street French. For lunch that afternoon, the pirates delivered a large, restaurant-prepared platter of rice, yellowish and decorated with wedges of lime. For some reason, they brought a separate bowl for me.
"You get extra?" said Raleigh.
"I don't know. I don't want extra." We shared it equally. Cut arrived at the house while we ate. Strange voices outside began to shout. Our guards gravitated to rooms across the hall to watch the commotion through the windows. Even Angelo stood up to crane his head. "What's the problem?" I asked. Angelo patted his hand at me as if patting an invisible dog. The shouting grew louder. Angelo picked up his gun, and I felt a wash of anxiety.
"Angelo," Raleigh whispered, "problem?"
Angelo shook his head.
"Problem cut."
The noise rose to a near riot. The only word I could make out was not cut, but Boris. That was the word for rice.
"Boris, Boris,"
the strangers were shouting. I looked at Raleigh and nodded at the platter.
"Someone saw them deliver our lunch," I said.
Either it was a food riot or the fancy tray had tipped off a rival group to our presence. It occurred to me that members of Gerlach's subclan might want to rescue us. A rescue by seals sounded risky enough. I hadn't considered the prospect of a Somali militia battle. The shouting grew louder. Ahmed Dirye came in to dig through a pile of belongings in the corner for his military vest, an olive-green jacket with pockets for Kalashnikov magazines. He strapped it around his belly.
"No problem," he told us and stepped out.
Raleigh grunted. On a normal day as a hostage, the worst condition is uncertainty, a sheer terror of what might happen. This riot made it worse. The ferocity of the shouting altered like the weather, but never dissolved. I didn't believe Angelo about the cot. On the other hand, I couldn't imagine pirates growing so passionate about anything else except maybe a fight over hostages. We heard gunfire, crackling warning gunfire aimed at the sky, but the noise rolled on and on, rising and subsiding for most of the afternoon. We felt like trapped animals. "I don't want to die," I thought. "I don't want to die." The riot was a mockery of my fledgling wish for a military raid. I sat on my mattress in a pair of thin cotton shorts and a t-shirt, helpless as a boy, leaning against the yard-thick walls and wondering how to defend myself against death when it came, if it came, in a scatter of ricocheting rifle rounds. Angelo sat down again and mumbled,
"No problem."
Raleigh tapped me on the elbow.
"These men always say, 'No problem, Michael.' When they say, 'Problem,' I think on that day, we die."
"We might die right now," I suggested.
"No, say that," Raleigh answered.
When the riot dissipated, Raleigh turned to our guard and said,
"Angelo, why?"
"Problem, Brice," I interjected with a crooked smile.
"Problem, cut,"
Angelo said. Chapter 6. When we complained about the wretched toilet room, pirates took us elsewhere for piss breaks and showers. Out to an expanse of white rocks littered with goat and human shit. Beyond this dead zone stood the crumbling walls of an even older house, which someone had built by mortaring field rocks together. When I took a shower inside this ruin, I noticed that rotting wooden beams were slanting through the tops of the rough white walls. Also European-looking, like something from a spaghetti western. Below us, to our right, lay the dull ranked houses of modern Hobyo. Beyond them, the vast blue sea.
I wondered if Hanley had seen these buildings after the war. He certainly knew the feelings they evoked. The heat and isolation and dry loneliness of Somalia had carried some British soldiers to the edge of suicide, and Hanley tried to make sense of the ones who pulled the trigger. It does not follow that because all the suicides I knew were very serious, earnest men with little sense of humor, that only the humorless kill themselves when they are in good physical health and still young, he wrote. We do not know the size and strength of our manias until they fall upon us and drag us down, or the barrenness of our inner deserts until real loneliness, fear, bewilderment, and sun madness have cast us into them. I wasn't yet in the grip of a mania. Not sun mad, not bewildered, but suicide was more than a literary topic for me. My father had killed himself. Mom had called it a heart attack to protect my impressionable mind, and I could understand the compulsion to shield a 12-year-old kid from the shattering awareness that his father no longer wanted to live. But the fairy tale had lasted almost 30 years. I'd learned about his suicide only after some research as an adult. I did remember Dad's drinking bouts, how he yelled when he drank, then forgot what he yelled. He also took Tylenol with codeine. He suffered from arthritis in his back, and before my mother evicted him, I remember Dad standing up from a nap one weekend afternoon to find her watering plants in the yard. 5 hours, no pain, he said, and he must have meant the codeine because he said it with the earnest passion of a man who wanted to convince his wife of something questionable. That Tylenol is super, he said. Mm-hmm, Mom said. Her attitude to his shysterism was to roll her eyes and keep watering the oleanders. Mom was a liberated woman for her time and place. Tennis playing, cigarette smoking, ironic. But even from her earliest girlhood, she had a conservative understanding of right and wrong. Her first full sentence, as a 2-year-old, burst out at a zoo in Frankfurt in the 1940s, when an elephant stole a wooden stick from her young hands by reaching its trunk through the bars of its cage. "Elephant took my stick," she blurted, looking for justice from the adults around her. "But he's not allowed." After 70 years, that story surfaced sometimes at family dinners in L.A. or Cologne to howls of laughter. Moving from a small German town to L.A. in the 60s was a long, pioneering step, glamorous from one point of view, dangerous from another, and her father at first refused to fly halfway across the planet just to visit her. The family lived in Europe, either in Catholic parts of the Rhineland in Germany or across the border in southern Holland. But Mom liked the new world. Germans impressed her as kind of stuffy and cold. She was traditional but free-spirited. She liked the weather in California. She liked the wine and the tennis in December. She kicked Dad out at the start of 1981. He found a bachelor apartment in our neighborhood and checked himself into an alcohol rehab center called Raleigh Hills, a short-term residential hospital with psychologists and counselors, mild and soft-spoken people who, when I visited, made a point of explaining alcoholism as an incurable disease, how it altered the mind, how it could turn a strong man into a raging stranger. A 12-year-old could understand that. But I didn't understand the pills, and when Dad seemed to master his urge for alcohol in the middle of his year of exile, I thought he'd won. He asked to move home from his apartment. Mom said no. "He wasn't ready," she said afterward. "He hadn't even quit drinking. He certainly hadn't given up the codeine." We learned about his death at the end of the summer, only when he failed to show up for work. The police went to his apartment and opened the door. Mom came home and told me the news. I believed her heart attack version of events because everything Dad liked was bad for his heart. Cigarettes, booze, the rim of fat on every barbecued steak. But even at 12, it was a surprise to hear that no one would conduct an autopsy. How could they know it was a heart attack? That discrepancy, along with some others, lingered at the back of my mind long into what I thought of as a well-adjusted adulthood. In 2010, I ordered a copy of his death certificate on a hunch. I had just read Legend of a Suicide, the novel by David Vann, which paints an adolescence lived under the shadow of a father's suicide. It sounded like a grim way to grow up. I'm glad that didn't happen to me, I thought, about a week before Dad's death certificate came in the mail. I opened the envelope standing at my breakfast table in Berlin, which overlooked the cobblestones and the swaying, wavering, massive green trees in the park. I pulled out the colored certificate and saw four strange words in the bureaucratic box.